Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, are you ready for an intellectual, spiritual field trip? Well, Ken, my baggage is packed.
All right.
Actually, I got left off.
You got thrown under the bus. Huh?
That's right. But you and Dave got to go on a very good trip, and we're going to hear all about it. Actually, some people got a lot of fun out of this one, and they got to join you. So we're going to get some good information on this one and some special insight as well. So let's hear all about it.
Yeah, let me begin by saying that when I was a kid, we would go on field trips. You know, they'd put us on the bus and send us somewhere. And at the time, you know, you're on the bus with all of these kids, and it seems like kind of a boring, difficult thing. I have to say, I look back on those field trips fondly, and yeah. I can further say that with my kids, there were times in which we took family field trips. One time we went to Washington, D.C., another time we went to Gettysburg, and my kids never forget all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. They'll remember the time, Dad, we did this. Well, Dave and I had a great opportunity. Reasons to Believe put together a trip to England, and a number of RTB supporters went along with us, and we spent 11 days there. Some people spent a little longer, took a little extra days, but Hugh and Fuzz and myself and Dave Rogstad were on that trip, along with a number of other RTB people. Ken Holtgren, who is works in events, was one of the person planning it, along with Tiffany and Gina, names that are important people here at Reasons to Believe. But we also had about, I think there were about 40 people right around there, give or take, who went with us. And I want to talk a little bit about what it was like to go on what I delightfully thought was a intellectual and spiritual field trip, going to another part of the world and looking at some extraordinary things.
Wow. Okay, let's hear more.
Well, as I mentioned, in the month of May, Dave and I and Fuzz and Hugh and Kathy Ross and a number of people at RTB went to Great Britain. We went to England, and we spent 10 days there. We, of course, spent a week touring, looking, sightseeing, spending time looking at historic and remarkable sites leading up to the Unbelievable Conference. This is with Justin Brierley. We've had Justin on, I think he was on our Imago Dei program. Justin Brierley is a host of a Christian radio program.
Premier Radio Networks.
That's right.
Yeah. He does fine work over there in the UK.
Often has people involved in debates on his program. I've debated an atheist, a Buddhist, a Hindu. I know Fuzz has been on his debate program, so has Hugh. So they have an annual conference. I think there were more than maybe 600 people.
Around 600, yeah.
At the conference. And so we spent a week kind of touring and then spent time speaking at the Unbelievable Conference, and then stayed another day. Some of us spoke at churches there in London. And I want to share some thoughts about that trip. I want to talk about some places that I visited. I want to talk about some ideas. I want to talk about how important Christianity has been in influencing the world in which we live. And I remember when I stepped out onto London, there are many thoughts that kind of went through my mind seeing London. I mean, in America, you know, if in California, if you want to see an old building, you might find a building that is in the latter part of the 19th century. You know, mm-hmm. You might find a building that's a little bit more than 100 years. And old, and if you do, that's a pretty old building. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can go back east, and you can go back to some of the early places, and you might get a building that's a couple hundred years, maybe even dating back, you know, to the 17th or 18th century, and that's pretty old.
Right.
But then you go to London, and you discover that the Romans are the ones who went through England for the first time. So the city of London was a Roman city. The city of London then became a medieval city. And when you walk into various places and buildings, you know, I remember when I was at Oxford, and I'll mention our tour there, but I remember them saying, well, this is a newer building. Well, how new is that? Well, it's, you know, several hundred years old. It's it's practically brand new, you know. And I'm thinking, as I'm walking on a tour in Oxford, I'm thinking, there were people right here almost 1,000 years ago. Mm. And so when I was in London for the first time, I you know, you kind of have thoughts that run in your mind, and I was immediately thinking, what would it be like to be in London when the German bombers were bombing London? Mm. This is called the Blitz, circa 1940. Germany is winning World War II, and America is not yet in the war. And the British are very concerned, not only that the Germans are bombing their city, but they may invade the island. In fact, I read while I was over there that C.S. Lewis and the Inklings had a discussion about which of their books might be put on the forbidden reading list if the Germans occupied England. So there was a real awareness that, you know what, the Germans may win this war. And so, you know, I discovered that 45% of London was destroyed in the Blitz.
Wow.
20,000 people died. And if you think back to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's hard to go to London and not think about C.S. Lewis. But in the beginning of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the children are being taken out of London into the country part of England. And that's where Oxford is. Oxford's out in the country. It's named after a bunch of ox, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So in the beginning of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is the first book in the Chronicles of Narnia series, the children are being sent out because London was being so devastated, 20,000 people killed. So I was thinking to myself, wow, you know, what would it be like to hear the German bombers above London. And then I thought C.S. Lewis gave talks on the BBC. In fact, he became so popular that after the war, Winston Churchill wanted to give him a medal. He thought that he played a significant role. And these talks, by the way, that Lewis gave on the BBC, they became the book Mere Christianity. So I was thinking about that. And of course, I was thinking about my early memories of this rock and roll group called the Beatles. And I was having all of these thoughts about this remarkable
city. That was thousands of years ago,
oh,
right?
Well, it was more than 50 years ago, which for me is a long time ago. Well, you know, going to England struck me for a number of reasons. It struck me, number one, how rich Western civilization really is when it comes to ideas. And it struck me how much Christianity has influenced the Western world. And I want to talk a little bit, and Dave, I want you to add and augment some mm-hmm. of your experiences. Some of the things that I saw really challenged me to think. The first day I was there, Joan and I went to the British Museum. And I walk into the British Museum and I see the Rosetta Stone. And I wow. I just couldn't believe I was seeing the Rosetta Stone. This is a stone where the ancient Egyptians, of course, wrote in hieroglyphics, which is the use of images, right, to convey. And afterwards, they didn't know how to translate the hieroglyphics. And so this Rosetta Stone has a statement in hieroglyphics followed by a statement in modern Egyptian and then in Greek. And so the way they were able to discover how the hieroglyphics were to be read was in light of these other languages. And I thought, how linguistic, you know, how important language is in terms of conveying these ideas. And again, I thought, the idea of being a people of the book, that human beings, what makes Fuzz Rana often talks about this, is what makes human beings exceptional is this linguistic ability that we have. That the animal kingdom is remarkable. I mean, animals have this almost intuitive awareness of how to track things in the natural world. Birds reading the stars and, animals having the capacity to track things. But human beings use language. And so here I was looking at this Rosetta Stone, and I sent an email, I sent a Facebook post, and one of my Greek professors says, did you translate it? Well, I was trying. I was trying to, as I was giving people elbows to try to get closer to it, right? You know, the British Museum is really a rather remarkable museum. I saw a bust of Socrates, and there's just remarkable things that I was able to see there. And I began to realize how influential the United Kingdom has been around the world. And of course, in our time, they get a lot of criticism because some of these remarkable artifacts, there are nations who say, we want those back.
They stole them
from us.
Yeah.
Some have critically called it the Museum of Plunder. I think, however, what we begin to realize is that in many ways, though the British could be pretty difficult and even at times brutal in their treatment, in many ways, the things we know about the Western world are preserved by the British.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just remarkable walking into a museum and seeing things that go back to ancient Egypt. Seeing parts of the Parthenon in Greece. Mm-hmm. And, this museum that's absolutely free, and you could just spend so much time. I had jet lag flying over, and after a couple hours in there, I was like, I need a nap. You know, I'm trying to process all of this kind of thing. Another day, I was at a Salisbury Cathedral, which I'll talk a little bit about more a bit later, but they had the Magna Carta in the church.
Wow. And that goes back to...
Oh, it goes back
13th century.
About the 13th century, 13th, I think.
Yeah, you're right.
And this is a document that really was about, the freedom of people in the Western world. Mm. And I'm allowed to go right up to it and see this document, and I'm thinking, wow, here I am walking, first of all, in this remarkable church that goes back to the Middle Ages, but now I've seen this political document, this document about human freedom and the dignity of the freedom that human beings have. And I thought, boy, to see these documents, these are documents that changed the world. These are ideas that I used to read about in textbooks,
mm-hmm.
and here they are right in front of me, and I'm seeing them, and I'm thinking about them. So it was an amazing place to bump into all of these things. And one thing I discovered is that a lot of times people who live in London, they've never seen these things.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. They kind of take them for granted. They become familiar. And I'm thinking, you got the Rosetta Stone, the Magna Carta?
How thick was the glass?
Well, what was interesting, the glass around the Rosetta Stone was pretty thick, but not so with the Magna Carta. I was like, wow, I could get right up to it.
Mm.
Another place we visited that struck me, and again, for anybody who knows me, World War II is a topic that it's been a big part of my life. One of the days we were able to go to the Churchill War Rooms, and this was the underground headquarters for Churchill and his war leaders. And we were able to go under there and see where he lived and how the Brits commanded, you know, and I thought to myself, you know, before America came in the world, because I'm an American, I often think about World War II in American terms. Victor Davis Hanson, who is a classical historian and a historian of World War II, he said that World War II was probably won, and this is, of course, a summary, and it may be an overstatement, but he said World War II was won by British know-how and Russian blood and American productivity. And, you know, I started to think, you know, in 1940, if you think about World War II, it begins September 1st, 1939. It ends in Europe in May of 45. That's VE Day. Victory in Europe is in May 8th, 1945. VJ Day, victory in Japan, extends out until the atomic bombing is in August, and then VJ Day is in September 1945. It's interesting, the war only lasted 44 months. Vietnam lasted 10 years. You know, it's extraordinary what was accomplished by the Allies. But as I thought about it, I realized there was a time when Britain, this little tiny island, I mean, the island isn't, you know, I think about America and our 50 states and, you know, 3,000 miles from one end of the country to the other. Britain is this tiny little island. And there was a time when Germany was winning the war and Britain stood alone. And, you know, I saw a part of a speech by Churchill who was trying to coax and beg and plead with Franklin Roosevelt to come into the war and help us. But I remember Churchill saying that, you know, we stand alone, and if the Allies won't help us, we'll continue to stand alone. And I thought, what extraordinary things, you know, happened. And I began learning what it was like to, you know, to live in a city that's bombed. I read that Britain was bombed 57 nights in a row. And can you imagine? Can you imagine that? Can you imagine being in the city? Can you imagine what that does to your central nervous system to be bombed day after day after day, and, you know, to never give up? I got to see where Churchill had a little cot, a little bed, you know. I thought, this is really cool to be able to see these things.
And his war rooms, I think.
His war rooms, yeah, Churchill's war rooms. Well, let me also talk a little bit about some of the churches that I saw. I got to go to a Catholic church called Westminster Cathedral. And, you know, you need to realize that prior to the Reformation, Britain is a Catholic country. It's a medieval Christian country. Before that, it's a part of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. But we went to Westminster Cathedral, and it was a very large cathedral with a very large crucifix. And I liked the church. I enjoyed seeing it. In fact, I think I liked Westminster Cathedral more than St. Paul's Cathedral. And that's a strange thing for me to say as a Protestant and as a person who appreciates Anglicanism. But I don't know, St. Paul struck me more as a museum, whereas Westminster Cathedral struck me more as a church that people actually go to. I know they go to St. Paul's as well, but it was just interesting to see a church that, again, echoed back to the Middle Ages. And to walk around, I saw a key row, the symbol of Christ that was on the wall. We also went to St. Paul's Cathedral, and talk about a mega church. Talk about one with, you know, a deep history. St. Paul's goes back, again, even prior to the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And when we made it up to the altar, I saw a statement on the altar. It thanked the American war dead, the American soldiers who were killed in World War II, standing with the British. I thought, wow, what an amazing kind of connection. And so when I was there, I recognized this kinship that the Americans and the British have shared. And, you know, the idea of an ally, working together. I mean, yeah, you have to realize in World War II, there may have been 70 million people killed. And most of the people killed by the Axis powers. So we're talking Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, and at the time, Italy, fascist Italy. Most of the people killed by the Axis were civilians.
Yeah.
Mass murder on an incredible scale. And for the Allies to battle that, you know, World War II is the biggest, most influential event, arguably, in the history of humanity. And you see it right there in London, which, of course, makes me uncomfortable when I realize that almost a quarter of millennials don't know anything about the Holocaust. You know, Britain brings to you the importance of history and how significant these events were. Well, we also went to another cathedral, Salisbury Cathedral, which was a Roman Catholic church in the Middle Ages. And at the time of the Reformation, it became an Anglican church. And I was talking to one of the scholars there, and he called it an Anglo-Catholic church. And this was the church that had the Magna Carta. And you know, when I walked into the church, Joe and Dave, I wanted to worship God. The structure of the church, the aesthetics of the church, the beauty of the church, it was like, you know, this is not like the churches I've gone to in my life. I was just kind of caught with the glory and the magnitude that this cathedral was pointing to God. And I just wanted to fall on my knees and worship the Lord. And I thought, I said on my Facebook page, I'd be 70% more spiritual if I went to that church.
You know, 70%.
it's just an extraordinary place to visit. And to recognize that for a lot of these cities, a lot of these people couldn't read and write in the Middle Ages. And this cathedral was their way of kind of coming to the center of the city and directing their attention to the Lord. You don't have to read and write to capture the splendor in these medieval cathedrals. And so I know there are Christians who think, you know, it's more about your spiritual life, you know, it's less about, you know, the medal and the physical church. I could tell you, there is, I think, something that the medieval Christians realized that maybe we don't when it comes to just the glory of God that's represented there. I don't know what you think, Dave.
Well, I remember when we went into that cathedral. I think it may have been the Westminster Cathedral. And I asked Ken, what is your sense when you come into this cathedral? And that's what he said, that it's the sense of wanting to worship God and so on. And that's not my reaction. Now, I'm impressed with the architecture and the amazement of, you know, what they built here. But I don't have that reaction. So I was reflecting on that as time went on. And then I said to Ken later that what struck me was that his reaction to this cathedral and to the art and the beauty of it is very similar to the reaction that I have when I listen to certain pieces of music, that I am just overwhelmed with the glory of the music. And I'm not talking about church music. I'm talking about, you know, Beethoven classical music. Bach was trying to write to the glory of God, but just the amazement of that music causes me to have that same. Yeah. So I can identify with Ken in the sense of the response, but not what creates the response.
Yeah, it just struck me how I just the grandeur, the splendor, the beauty. There was there was something about this beautiful element, and I think that's right. I think that beauty operates in our life on a profound level. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like, man, I can't believe how a sense of joy I felt walking into a place like this. And I thought, can I go to church here? You know, can I sign up for this?
Well, I hope people are attending now. Did you get a sense that they are?
Well, there are St. Paul's is a working church. Westminster Cathedral is a Catholic mm-hmm. church. I think Salisbury Cathedral, even though it's very large, I think a part of it's used as a church. And so there's one sense in which it's a museum. On the other hand, it's this incredible. And of course, a lot of these ideas go back to the way Christian thinkers thought about this. Let me say just briefly. Protestant churches reacted against medieval cathedrals. John Calvin, one of the many things that he said that is well known, Calvin said the human mind is like an idolatry factory. And, you know, I think you need to realize that for Luther and Calvin and the other reformers, they felt that they were encountering a very superstitious form of Catholicism. And, you know, the sell of indulgences at times. I'm happy when I meet Catholics who realize that the Catholic Church, in some respects, had lost its way. But Protestant churches, in many ways, particularly in the Reformed tradition, less so in the Anglican. The Anglican are more use the aesthetic elements in the service. But in a Reformed church, there is no art except for music. And so very little stained glass and things of that nature. And, of course, part of that's controversial. Catholics have statues. And the Orthodox have icons where these beautiful images, paintings of Jesus, the saints, the Virgin Mary, are tended to kind of give you an insight into the spiritual realities. Well, Protestants are like, whoa, I don't know about that. I kind of find myself in the middle. I love stained glass. There was something about the aesthetic element that just kind of set my heart free in that way. Let me talk a little bit about some of the other things. On Tuesday, we went to Oxford University, which is about 90 miles from London. So we're on a bus, and I was asked to give a talk about C.S. Lewis. So I talked a little bit about who he was and why he was important and the books that he had written and many things about his life. But, you know, going to Oxford, I realized this is arguably the oldest or one of the oldest universities in the Western world. You know, going back more than 900 years,
wow,
almost 1,000 years old. And, you know, walking through, I realized that this was a medieval city. And along with Cambridge and the University of Bologna and Paris, these are some of these extraordinary universities. And by the way, it's these medieval universities, Christian universities, for the most part, Catholic universities. These are the universities that where the firepower comes forth to birth science. These are the institutions of learning. And I realized that John Calvin and Thomas Aquinas had gone to the same university. I thought, wow, that's a pretty good alumni, you know. we got Thomas and Calvin. you know, again, we look at the Ivy League schools, but here is a school. And so we're walking around, and the tour guide's kind of guiding us toward, and we walk by the Eagle and the Child pub. This is a little pub there in Oxford where the Inklings would meet, and they had their little room in the back. So C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and Dyson and all these literary individuals met on a Tuesday morning. They also met Thursday night at Lewis's place there at Oxford. But as Dave and I were walking in, I was rubbing my arm on the wall, hoping it would rub off on me. I felt delighted to actually have been there. And of course, there are photographs of Lewis and Tolkien. And, you know, you begin to think, here's two guys who were part of World War One. And, World War One sometimes gets dwarfed by World War Two, but World War One was the war to end all wars. It was this extraordinary war where people began to use things like machine guns and primitive tanks. This was modern warfare.
Airplanes.
And I began to realize that, you know, these movies that I watch about Lewis and Tolkien, and of course based upon the books that they've written, there's a reason why Lewis and Tolkien have these monumental battles. Undoubtedly, they're remembering, you know, Tolkien was at the Battle of the Somme, probably the greatest battle of World War One. And, you know, these guys come out of that context and meet at Oxford. It was really really an extraordinary thing to realize that here's two Christian authors in this pub writing out their manuscripts. Mm-hmm. And Tolkien said after Lewis died, he said, you know, if not for my friend Jack Lewis, he said, I probably would have never finished The Lord of the Rings. Mm. And The Lord of the Rings and The Chronicles of Narnia are two of the best-selling book series in the history of humanity. Mm. And so, you know, you walk by, I thought, boy, pour me a beer. You know, I'd like to sit down there and kind of breathe all this in. Of course, going to Oxford meant that we not only could see the Eagle and the Child, where the Inklings met, but we also went to the Kilns. This was Lewis's home. He moved there about 1930, lived there with his brother, Warney. And one of the interesting elements about Lewis is he had a friend in World War One, and his friend was named Paddy Moore. In fact, Lewis had about five or six friends who were all killed. He had a real survivor guilt. That he was the only one of his kind of inner circle that made it through the war alive. But him and Paddy Moore made a contract with each other. You know, if I die, you take care of my parents. And Paddy Moore was killed. And so Lewis cared for Mrs. Moore an extended period. And so he bought that home at the Kilns. And there were C.S. Lewis scholars there. Colin Duryea was there. I'd met Colin before. Got to walk through the rooms and see this house that, you know, Lewis lived in.
Have they left it intact then, the way it was?
Pretty much.
Okay.
A lot of the original items were purchased by, you know, the C.S. Lewis societies here in America, but yeah, they try to keep it as intact, and they have Lewis specialists who are there, okay, who can give you a talk. Then I'd been to the Kilns before, but I also went over to, the group of us went over to Holy Trinity Anglican Church where Lewis is buried. Mm-hmm. And I walk into this church, and it's like this wonderful, musty smell. It's like, I told Dave, this is the way churches should smell. So we went in and sat in the pews, and we got to hear one of the persons who worked at the church, you know, and he said, yeah, C.S. Lewis is probably our most popular congregant, you know. Yeah, I'll bet. But they had Michael Ward, who is a C.S. Lewis scholar. I'd met Michael before. He gave a talk about Lewis's influence, and we got to ask questions about him. And then we went out and saw Lewis's grave, and you know, very modest in many respects, but it was here he is buried in the church ground, which, by the way, is a very common practice in church history, where you would, if you belonged to that church, you'd be buried there. And of course, the idea is that you're going to walk out of church one of these days and all these people are going to be raised from the dead, you know. But it was It's an amazing thing. I was struck by a couple things. I wonder if you guys have any comments. One thing that struck me about C.S. Lewis is he really influences a diversity of people. I mean, I know Reformed people who won't have anything to do with Arminian people, and Arminians return the favor, and Catholics and Protestants bicker at each other, and, you know, there's a lot of times theological circles are not terribly friendly with one another. But I know a number of Reformed people who really like Lewis. And then there, I know a number of Wesleyan Arminians who love Lewis and Catholics who like him. And I think Lewis had this extraordinary way of speaking to many different types of Christians. And I think that that's kind of an extraordinary thing. One of the things I discovered on my trip there was that when Lewis put together Mere Christianity, again, these were the talks that he gave on the BBC, he brought them together and kind of cemented them into the essay of the book. But he sent them to four different Christian ministers in different denominations and asked them, you know, have I gone too far? Have I said too much, or have I said too little? He really was trying to represent this idea of Mere Christianity. And of course, the backdrop of all of this is he's from Belfast, Ireland. And that's been a hotbed of a lot of hostility between so-called Catholic and Protestant forces. But it was intriguing to see the world of C.S. Lewis and how much influence he's had.
One
on
thing that struck
others.
Me was that I asked the guy who was kind of our guide.
Yeah.
Excuse me. What was it like? Lewis, apparently, when he became a Christian, along with his brother, decided maybe we should go to church.
Yeah.
And so they decided to walk down to this little church. It was a small church.
Yeah. Holy Trinity Anglican Church.
And I asked him, well, you know, was he mixing with the people? Oh, no. He was sitting way over. He and his brother sat in the back over on one side. And as soon as the service was over, they were gone. And interestingly, too, there were two services in the church, and it was the first service that didn't have the singing of hymns in contrast to the second service.
Yeah.
And Lewis, at least at that stage in his life, didn't like singing, didn't like doing that. And so he was a shy person, and I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, that struck me too, Dave. There are times in your church experiences you know, some people are more gregarious, other people are, you know, a little quieter, or there are times where I'm sure I'm perceived as a bit kind of an aloof intellectual person. But here's C.S. Lewis sitting in the back, you know, kind of, I thought, well, if it's good enough for Lewis, maybe it's good enough for me. Yeah. But I also wanted to, you know, I also wanted to touch upon that idea that, you know, there are times where we recognize that the people that we have had a big influence, we see their own realization. And one thing that I learned a couple years ago when I read Alistair McGrath's biography on C.S. Lewis, it was the 50th anniversary of Lewis's death. Lewis, of course, died the same day, same hour as President Kennedy in 1963, November 22nd. And Lewis was very popular in America, more popular in America than in England. And a lot of the Christians didn't know about Lewis's death for a couple weeks because of the tremendous press about JFK's death. But, you know, when I was kind of working through a lot of that, I realized, it was just kind of interesting to see Lewis. And McGrath said that Lewis was very shy, that he had social anxiety. And, you know, this book that I've written about Christian leaders, it was kind of interesting for me to see, you know, their warts, their difficulties, and it kind of gave me an awareness that just as I struggle with my limitations and weaknesses, these Christian thinkers did as well. But we got to hear a lecture by John Lennox at Oxford. He was very gracious to us. We got to go in and hear a talk, and when it was a Q&A time, I asked John, I said, John, I know that you were you heard Lewis lecture. I wonder if you could give us a story or some of your remembrances. And he says, yes. He said, I remember going to hear Lewis, and it was just packed. He said, students sitting on the floor against the wall, you know, just everybody's lined up to hear Lewis lecture. And they said he comes in at the last second. And of course, it's cold in England a good part of the year. So Lewis has a hat on, a scarf, and a jacket. And Lennox says the moment Lewis walks in the room, he starts lecturing. And he's taken off his hat and his scarf and his jacket, and he's already, you know, presented the lecture material. And then as the lecture starts to come to a close, Lewis goes over and picks up his hat. He's still talking, puts his scarf back on and his jacket. And as soon as the last word of the lecture, he's out the door.
Wow.
And it was just interesting to hear John Lennox.
No Q&A.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Lewis kind of set his own standard of how things were to be done. But it was a remarkable time. We got to hear Michael Ward. We got to hear John Lennox. Another day, on Wednesday, I went to the Premier Radio, the Unbelievable program. I went to the studio and met Hugh Fuzz and I met there. And Hugh had a debate with Peter Atkins, who is a leading atheist. He's a chemist. Fuzz said to him, Peter, I used your textbook when I first started studying chemistry. But in the first few minutes with us, so it's Hugh Ross, Fuzz Rana, myself, Peter Atkins, he basically told me that Christianity was rubbish. What else did he say? Nonsense. So we kind of had
set the tone right away.
We had a kind of an apologetic, you know, going back and forth with him. But it was kind of interesting. I said, Dr. Atkins, I said, do you know Richard Swinburne? This frown came over. Richard Swinburne, of course, is this great Christian philosopher, professor at Oxford for many, many years. He's had a lot of debates with these new atheists. So Atkins' demeanor kind of dropped. And I said, you know, what do you think of Swinburne? He goes, well, I disagree with him. And he says, do you ever disagree with Swinburne? I said, well, sometimes. But I said, most of the time we agree because we're Christian theists. So I said, well, let me ask you, do you know Richard Dawkins? He goes, yeah, Dawkins and I are really tight. I said, do you ever disagree with him? He says, never. I thought, well, that's interesting. The Christians disagree with each other, but the atheists don't. So we had this kind of sparring back and forth. But I prayed for him. I thought, you know, I asked him, I said, is it hard to retire? I said, you've been a professor at Oxford for a long time. And I could tell, I surmised that I think he was wrestling with the issue of my life is coming to a close. And what am I going to be remembered for? And it was just interesting to hear an atheist, and I considered it a great opportunity to meet a very influential thinker. But boy, he was so dismissive, you know. And I thought to myself, I shared with Fuzz and Hugh in the taxi. It's another thing to go into a taxi in London. It's quite an interesting place to be. But I was sharing with Fuzz and Hugh that I said, you know, I have doubts about my faith at times. It shows my hypocrisy. I wrote a book without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Here I am admitting I do have doubts. I do have doubts. There are things I don't understand about the faith. There are times where I wish I knew a lot more. But I thought I didn't feel like Peter Atkins had many answers at all. It was just, I'm not willing to consider any of that. And I thought, you know, I'm willing to consider alternative perspectives to my view. And I'm even willing to say that sometimes my views aren't as robust as I would like, but he wouldn't concede anything. So it's just kind of interesting. Who are the critical thinkers? Is it always the skeptic, atheist, or could it be Christians are actually more critical? It was kind of an interesting time.
Yeah.
A couple other places that we visited. We went to Stonehenge.
Yes, all right.
Let's hear about that. It was a long bus ride, and we went to Stonehenge.
Did you find out who made it?
Well, we were out there, and there are different theories.
Oh, really?
There are different theories as to how to explain Stonehenge. Mm. Some people would say, for example, that it was kind of a spiritual temple that was being built. So it's a reflection of ancient religiosity, and maybe again part of the worship of the stars reflected in all of that. Another theory is that it was seen as a temple of healing, that some of the remains that they have discovered there have led some people to believe that maybe some of them saw it as a place you could go to be healed. And another theory that kind of slips my mind at the moment, another one is UFOs, right?
Ah,
so there was
go.
The discussion of all of this, but it was interesting to walk around. In the old days, I'm told you could actually go and climb on the stones and etch your name in them.
Wow. Oh, really?
Not now. They keep you 50 yards away.
When we visited Stonehenge 48 years ago, my family and my wife and I and our small kids lived in Holland, and we went to visit just a short time. But, yeah, we were free to run around. The kids were climbing on the rocks, and it's considerably different.
Yeah.
Than it is today.
You didn't etch your names in the stone.
No,
did you?
No, we didn't.
Well, it was an interesting place, you know, to see. And again, to think about is how do we understand these ancient ruins? Mm-hmm. Later in the week, we went to the Royal Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
And
Greenwich.
Greenwich. I found that really, really interesting. We got to go and see some of the photos and some of the artifacts of the earliest development of the Royal Observatory. And got to go in and have an experience where you sit and see the stars and the universe. I thought the astronomer was very articulate and engaging and kind of bringing you in. I was asking Dave about it, and he was saying the observatory here in Los Angeles maybe even better. But it was kind of interesting. I was asking Hugh, I wonder how many of these early leaders, how many of them were Christians? And when did the people in British science begin to move in more of a secular direction? I mean, Darwin's almost like a patron saint.
Wow.
He is very influential in Britain, so it was...
He's buried at Westminster Abbey.
He's buried at Westminster Abbey, which is quite another place to visit. You got all of these great artists and writers and musicians and scientists. Lastly, a couple places we went to the London Tower, and I got to see where people were captured and people who were
heads cut off
and all of this.
Torture is a part of the history over there,
that's
too.
That's right, yeah.
Bloody. That's...
The word bloody, which is a cuss word, by the way, in England. It's a word you don't necessarily want to use in polite company, but there's a lot of blood connected with it. But, in closing and kind of summarizing, I was really struck, Joe, by how much Christianity has influenced the Western civilization. And that as much as we think of other, great influential people, the person of Jesus and the truths of Christianity have left an enduring imprint on Western civilization. And it's probably true that Britain, is more secular now than maybe any time in its past, but you still see all of these influences. You see how extraordinary the Christian faith, the Christian worldview, and Christian ideas have had on the development of Western civilization. And you also saw, I think, one guy, one of the guys that was involved in the Andy Bannister, he was one of the apologetic speakers. He was teasing me. He called America, he referred to America as one of the colonies. So I said, I just wanted to thank you guys for helping us out in World War II. We're kind of jabbing each other a little back and forth. But, you know, I also realized how important, even though the beginning of America began with a revolt against the king, that the countries of England and America have deeply been connected in the centuries of the unfolding of Western civilization. And so, I want to say to the people listening, it's expensive to travel. Going overseas is an investment. I'm thankful that I, as part of RTB, I was able to go along. I was fortunate to have my wife accompany me. But I want to encourage people, particularly parents who have young people. I remember times we took some trips. We took two trips to Washington, D.C. My wife and I kind of wrestled, should we invest that kind of money in a trip? We have limited funds. I work in Christian ministry. How should I allocate our money? But I have to say that all of my children now are grown, and they all reference those kinds of experiences. And sometimes, if you can take those kinds of trips, you begin to see things that I only read about some of these things in books, and to walk in there and see them was really an extraordinary time.
Ken, I wonder if you might put a capper on it by commenting this way. I didn't go on the trip, and the two of you have. Someone here in America who has been looking at the news, say, over the last decade or more, might say, if you look at America and Europe and even very recently, the news in Ireland where there's been a reversal on the decision over abortion, someone might get discouraged and say the church has been losing ground, the church has been not as vibrant as it has been. What would your comment be? Because they haven't seen maybe the work of Justin Brierley's ministry and Premier Radio Networks. I think Ken Hultgren, when he came back, said, boy, their people are really alive over there. Those who are really involved in ministry would say there's a lot going on that you don't see. Maybe we're paying attention to a lot of the news and we get discouraging reports and that kind of thing. Maybe you can kind of put a capper on all this and based on what you have seen, and what would you say to that kind of comment?
What was interesting to me is I've been to England twice, and both times, talking with Christian people there, they were more vibrant than I expected. Mm-hmm. It is interesting. I mean, you have these very large churches, and there is only a trickle of people that are part of them, but what I discovered is there are some very dynamic people there who love the Lord. They love the Queen. I think the Queen of England is a genuine Christian. Everything I've seen about her indicates that she's a follower of Jesus Christ. I don't know that that's true about all the members of the royal family, but both of my experiences there indicate that apologetics and evangelism and Christian theology are still an important part of Great Britain. It's obviously has an influence of evolution and secularism. There's no doubt about that. But the Pew report says that by 2050, there's going to be 9 billion people in the world. Going to need a lot of jobs, going to need a lot of resources to feed 9 billion people. The Pew Forum says that if trends continue, there'll be 3 billion of the 9 will be Christian. About 3 billion will be Muslim, and then there'll be 3 billion others, religious and non-religious. I think there are reasons for optimism. You know, Christians, I think, need to be careful that they don't look at the news and decide, you know, based upon trends. Many of the people I encountered there were very vibrant. Sure, there are plenty of people that are secular. And you have lots of religious people, you know, Islam, other areas. But I was actually encouraged by the dedication of some of the ministers that I met there. And again, I say that I think Western civilization is by and large Christian civilization, and I don't think there's anything to compare to it. I think it's truly extraordinary.
All right. Well, thank you for this simulated trip. I've learned a lot. Yeah. And when I can get my act together, I will book that trip.
You need to learn to drive a bus so you can get on the bus with us, right?
All right. Thank you for that, Ken. Certainly appreciate it. Okay. This has been another podcast. We certainly hope you have enjoyed it. Thanks for coming along this ride with us. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
This podcast was made possible through the faithful support of Reasons to Believe donors. If you feel led to support ministry outreaches like this, visit give.reasons.org.